Welcome to Warships Pod. Our guest on this podcast, which is to be heard over two parts, because it really is a fascinating discussion, is Lee Pilgrim, who's already written a formidable array of pieces for the mag, and in one recent edition, something on a future Royal Navy submarine service that gets back to mixing diesel-electric submarines with nuclear boats. Lee has worked in defence and intelligence for government and for industry for over 30 years, working in the UK and overseas, so has some very useful insights into a whole load of interesting things, and hence the reason why we're going to put this across two episodes. Oh, and one other thing I should just mention. We did experience some connection issues during the recording, so that does affect some of the quality, but it is still a fascinating listen. Welcome aboard, Lee, and it's great to have you on.
Morning. Great to be here. Nice to meet you all.
Yeah, we could start off with looking at the current state of the RN and casting my mind back to a project I'm actually just about to start on a new edition of, which is our Guide to the Royal Navy, which has been going since 2002 and is going to be in its 12th edition when it comes out later this year. And I thought that it would be useful to look at our edition for 2006 of the Royal Navy Guide, because that came out at the end of 2005 in the wake of the amazing, spectacular Trafalgar 200 fleet review in the Solent. And so this morning I looked at the fleet list that we published there, and also a list of units of the Royal Navy that had been cut in 2003 to 2005. So the fleet list consisted of, and I'll be a bit boring here, two aircraft carriers, four ballistic missile submarines, nine attack submarines, 17 frigates, eight destroyers, three purpose-built amphibious ships, two LPDs, and a helicopter carrier, five survey vessels, including the tiny Gleaner, an ice patrol ship, and four patrol vessels, along with 16 mine hunters, 18 plastic patrol boats, training vessels as they are or were at that time, and then 19 vessels in the Royal Fleet Auxiliary. And then if you look at where we're going to be with the next guide, and I think currently are at the moment, having looked at our last edition, we are going to have in the Navy fleet list two carriers, four ballistic missile submarines, that's the same, five attack submarines with HMS Triumph, the last of the Trafalgar class Cold War SSNs having just paid off altogether, and then eight frigates, six destroyers, zero purpose-built amphibious vessels, three survey vessels, including the Magpie, which has replaced Gleaner. And then there's Protector, the current ice patrol vessel, which has been moved into the hydrographic squadron. And then we've got eight patrol vessels, including the River Class Batch 2, which are deployed overseas. And then eight mine hunter or mine warfare vessels, if you include Stirling Castle, which this week has just been transferred from the RFA into the Navy. 18 plastic patrol boats, those small things, and just nine RFAs. And totaling that, loading all that up into the calculation, in 2006, the total number of all units, including small ones, plastic ones, big ones like carriers, etc., and submarines, was 106. But prior to that fleet list that we had in the guide edition of 2006, 22 vessels had been paid off between 2003 and 2005. That made quite a lot. So that would make, 128 that we had in 2003. And so today, and who knows, by the time we do the guide, it might be slightly smaller, we have 72. So that's a kind of spotter's guide, Lee. Top trumps look at the Navy to sort of calibrate its size. So obviously there's a lot more going on and a lot more factors. So sort of leading on from that, what do you think is the actual state of the Royal Navy as we stand today? Well, and I believe that one thing you'd like to look at is the state of the Royal Navy as against the budget that's actually given to it.
Yeah. So if you look at the Royal Navy today and the vessels that it's actually got afloat, so whilst we can play the top trumps like we did back in 2006 and say these are the vessels that we've got, what we can actually put to sea should be the bigger cause for concern. So 2006, we could get ships to sea and they were regularly at sea. So we had ships in the Middle East, we had ships in the West Indies, we had ships in the Far East. Ships were out there doing their business. They were less efficient, so it was taking more ships to generate the ships to go out there, but they were out doing things. if we look at the fleet today, we've got HIMARS, which we'll go on to later, which is deploying the bulk of the active service, the surface fleet. That's all the available working surface vessels are out on HIMARS doing their thing. If we look at the Type 45s, HMS Daring, nearly 3,000 days not being at sea. So we're going to type, you know, it's great to talk about numbers. We've got six of it, and we've got eight Type 23s, and we've got five Astutes. What does that really mean? Well, what are we actually putting to sea? So Type 45, we've got one out with HIMARS. We've got one working up at the moment off the coast. That's two out of six. Type 23s, we've got one deployed on TAPS up in, so one is always declared up at TAPS, and we've got one out on HIMARS, and then we get one out every now and again. If we look at the submarines, which I'm sure we'll go on to later, once again, we've got nothing out. Everything is back in port. These submarines outturn at about £1.2 billion per vessel. So if you're a taxpayer and you're looking at five submarines all tied up, do you think you're getting best value for money? This was announced or talked about last year at the Defence Select Committee when Admiral Key was First Sea Lord, and they were asking him about the fact that no attack boats were at sea. And he came back with a very political answer. I've got all the vessels I need to complete all the tasks that are assigned to me at this particular time. I think the new First Sea Lord has taken a slightly different approach. I think he mentioned the fact that he looked forward to turning the Royal Navy back into a warfighting force. So whilst that's just one sentence, that tells you a lot about where certain members of the Royal Navy actually think the Navy is at the moment. The fact today we're counting P2000 university craft as vessels tells you an awful lot about the number of ships that we've got. If we quickly compare that to the Air Force, the Royal Air Force going through exactly the same. I recently did a thread on the size of the Royal Air Force in 2003 and the size of the Royal Air Force today. And we've lost about the same. We've lost about 50% of the metal that we had back then. Are we getting value for money for the £6 to £6.5 billion a year that the Navy is spending on keeping these vessels out and running? I don't think so. I think there are wider problems, and this has got lots to do with Optelic, Afghanistan, and the operational focus that the MOD sometimes uses to get the job at hand done. So with Afghanistan, for example, everything was deployed to Afghanistan, so lots of things were left to atrophy. Lots of things were left to sort of wither at the bone. If we look at the amphibious force at the moment, so amphibious Commando 2000 announced an amphibious force that would consist of a landing platform helicopter, HMS Ocean, two landing platform docks, four landing platform auxiliaries, and six auxiliaries to support that. Now, 20 years later, we've sold landing platform auxiliaries. We're about to sell the two landing platform docks. Our three LPD auxiliaries are all in port due to the RFA's lack of crew, and we're left with Argus. So in 20 years, the amphibious lift capability for the Royal Marines has gone from a fleet of deployable assets that could deploy anywhere around the world to what we have now, which is RFA Argus currently alongside in Pompey waiting for its Lloyd's certificate so it can go back to sea. So that's a whole capability that we've lost. The requirement hasn't moved, and I think that's one of the bigger worries. The requirement is still the same, but the capability is lost. It's very easy to lose a capability, very, very difficult to grow it again.
Yeah. Just a couple of things you mentioned there. TAPS, that's the rapid response frigate Type 23 that's held at Portsmouth, ready to go out and shadow Russians. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the Todorae patrol ship. So when we launch, so when we launch the deterrent, so the continuous at sea deterrent, everybody thinks that's just a single submarine. There's a whole ecosystem that goes behind that package to get the subs in and out. So they use attack boats, they use minesweepers, they use aircraft. But the thing that goes up, the thing that the Navy deploys, sort of military task number one, is making sure the towed array patrol ship, that Type 23 with its 2087, the big array that it trails out the back, can go and make sure that there are no Russian subs or no Russian ships snooping around as one of the boats go out to sea onto their patrols. So if you think of it as a key task for the Navy, this is key task number one, making sure the continuous at sea deterrent is out doing its business, which is why having no attack boats at sea becomes a worry. Those attack boats are the things that go up to deter the enemy from coming down to snoop around. CASD is being followed by the Russians. It's not much of a deterrent. because they know where it is. So not having those things in place puts real risk the capability, which is the only grand strategic capability that the MOD currently deploys on behalf of the UK government.
And that's the Trident missile submarines that we're talking about when you say, because I'm
that's
aware
the Trident
some
missile
listeners,
submarines,
yeah, some listeners won't be, maybe won't know everything, all the acronyms. But the bit where you said, was it what, $6 billion, whether or not it's value for money that we're getting out of the deployed assets, did you mean, are we deploying enough ships and units? Or what did you mean by that? Or did you mean those that go out are not doing the right mission?
It's the run cost. It's when you're looking at what money you're spending on the return on investment that you're getting back. So if you look at what's going on in the Gulf at the moment, two and a half years ago, we had four MCMVs, mine hunters, minesweepers. We had a Bay class and we had a presence. We've had the presence there since the early 1980s when the Armilla Patrol was there with the Type 42s, the Type 22s. Here we are now. We're now left with a single vessel and a Type 23 that will soon be coming back, not to be replaced. My question is, where is that $6 billion, that $6.5 billion going? What's it being used to spend on as we slowly pull these things back? What is going out to replace it? Are they being replaced? It just, before you could see tangibles, there are tangibles that you can see where the money is being spent. Now those tangibles are slowly disappearing. So people can say, and it gets reported in the newspapers, we have vessels in the Middle East. We have vessels east of Suez. We have vessels in the Red Sea. You can see tangible return on investment. The members of the public can say, yes, my money is being spent and there is a vessel doing a thing. As those vessels are slowly coming back in and you can photograph them alongside in port, you could ask the question, what is my money being spent on? Where am I getting my return on investment? It's nice and easy with the Royal Air Force. They're deployed all over the world. You go to air shows, you see the jets. You can say, yes, I can see tangibles. I can see my return on investment. My worry for the Navy as an ocean-going force is, where am I seeing those returns? I've got all my submarines back in port. I've got HMS Daring, 3,000 days it's been alongside. What value for money am I getting out of a platform that has put to sea for less time than it's been in service? Where is my return on investment for that? So that's what I mean when I talk about that. The investment hasn't gone down. The run costs haven't gone down. The number of vessels deployed have. So are they becoming more expensive? Are we spending money in the wrong way? Where is that money going? And this is separate from the capital money, the credit card money that the government used to buy things, Type 26, Type 31, and all the other things that the Navy are trying to do to recapitalize a fleet that's atrophied since about, as you said, 2006, 2007. You know, if you were to draw it as a linear graph, it would be a very, very sort of straight sort of graph of this is what we had, this is what we've got. But when you look at the budget, you say, well, the money being spent is roughly the same. So what value am I getting in return?
So is the answer, or is part of the answer, that there a lot of the money, despite it being, you know, allegedly set aside for operational deployments, et cetera, what's happening with it is it's being devoted to one particular thing, let's say carrier strike going on, Operation High Mast around the world, or it's being poured into trying to put right the infrastructure support problems in Devonport, in reality, you know, getting the docks that can refit the nuclear submarines and get them back out there. So is it being diverted, or is it a bit in a, you know, is it in a piggy bank somewhere, you know?
I think the run costs are just going up. If you look at the amount of maintenance now required to keep a Type 23 at sea, a ship that was designed for a 25-year life cycle, now in its 35th year of going through, I think that's where a lot of money goes. If we look at last year, trying to keep some of the Type 23s afloat, going through refit, spending a huge amount of money on trying to get them through refit, when the majority of us knew the platform would never go to sea, but the money was being spent anyway. The money was being invested in a platform that would end up being scrapped. It's those type of things. Dilly-dallying around whether to put a naval strike missile on or not. PIP is cost, you know, PIP will come out of that money, the propulsion improvement program for the Type 45s, you know, prop refits on carriers. All of that sort of drains that day-to-day running money, which someone sort of needs to say, well, when do we draw the line? When do we stop and say, and this goes on to the cuts and everything like that, when do we stop to say, right, we've reached a pinnacle point now where some of the things that we're trying to keep going, and I'll use HMS Daring again, just need to go. There's no point. We're not going to put it to sea again. You know, we're holding her so we can create an inflated number of the magic 19. You know, we need 19 FFGs, DDGs, large surface platforms on the books to maintain and look like we're, a Royal Navy. Someone somewhere needs to go, let's get real here and say, you know, look at the tasks that we're trying to generate. Look at the outcomes that we're trying to achieve. What best is to do that? Having imaginary numbers of 19 surface vessels held at readiness maybe isn't the best way to measure our combat effect anymore.
So what you're saying there is use it or lose it.
It's why hold on to something, you know, why have a car in your garage, that you're never going to use, that just sits there, you need to maintain it, you take parts off it, you tinker with it. You would hope that someone somewhere would get real and say, do you know what, we're never going to put her to sea. It's better to spend the money and the time and the energy on making sure that we can get Type 26 out, or making sure we can get Type 31 out, or making sure that the investment is made to get the rating back into the system, into the nuclear roles, into those pinch point roles, instead of saying, if you look along the quay side, look how many Type 45s I've got. They're all six of them. They're all, or five of them at the moment. They're all there. That's just a measuring game. That's not combat effect being measured. That's just the number of platforms that you've got, which isn't the best way to measure outcome sometimes.
Yeah, so that's kind of like a fleeting being mentality to try and cover up for the fact that nothing's happening and they're not prepared. Is it a case of it just needs more money, or is this going to be like maybe the NHS is often said to be, you know, chuck more money in and you still don't get anything out?
I don't trust the MOD to spend a penny. I wouldn't give them another penny because they haven't demonstrated they can spend the money that they've got well. Everything is a reaction to something. Everything is to cover a gap. If I'm the Treasury and I'm looking at the way that the MOD spends its money, I'm keeping my hands very much on my wallet until the MOD can demonstrate that the things that they're spending on shows real value for money. The MOD and the Navy and the others show contrition to say, yes, okay, we haven't got everything right. Here's what we're going to do. Here's the things that we're going to, we talk about defense cuts, which gets very emotive. These are not defense cuts. These are things that are not being used or can't be afforded to be used. I'll use that Type 45 HMS Daring. What value is she giving the Royal Navy today? What outturn is she giving? You know, better to have more vessels at sea, putting the money into that, getting sailors onto vessels, than having ships sat alongside. The way that they budget, for example, having done this for a while, the optimism bias that gets thrown into things, giving true costs is always a nice, useful thing to have. What is the true cost of a Type 26? What is the true cost of a Type 31? What is the true cost of a, you know, when the Queen Elizabeth carriers were first conceived all the way back in 1998 and then costed, the pair of them were costed at 2.9 billion. The outturn was 6.2 billion. So, you know, that's double the amount of money that was originally budgeted. That money has to come from somewhere. So someone set a budget, then someone within the department has set a forecast to say, this is the amount of money we are going to spend on this platform over the whole of its life. When that budget goes up, the money doesn't go up. So you're taking money from elsewhere. Everything just gets pushed to the right, which is, what's happening all the time. It just gets moved to the right. You do your two-year post. I've kept within my budget. I'm on to the next thing. So DNS, for example, they do a whole life costing process, which never gets used. Here is the whole life cost of F-35. It's anywhere between 18 to 71 billion pounds, depending on the number of platforms bought and the out service date. When you're not even getting those things nailed down, it's very difficult to budget. And then it's very difficult to Treasury to say, yes, we're going to give you more cash because, again, you've used optimism bias to get a program online, only to increase its cost later. A bit of a ramble, so I apologize.
No, that's good. That's good. So having, right. So as you were talking earlier, I was just thinking of, not wishing to upset any of our contributors in Argentina, but I was thinking of the Argentinian armed forces, in particular the submarine service, and how they had some submarines and kept them alongside for years and years and years, and then had no money at all to actually get them sorted, and then had a little bit of money, and two of them, I think, they cut in half and tried to make them better boats, and then they lost one, tragically. I think that was in 2017, yeah. With all the crew that imploded. So looking at our own submarine service with no boats at sea, and yet five SSNs I'm on about, not the Trident submarine,
yeah.
And with five Astute-class submarines, either, what, down here in Devonport, there's two of them down here at the moment, one actually in refit, one waiting to go in, and then a Trident missile boat here as well. So that's three out of the nine submarines that we've got. And then the others, Astute's just come back Anson has just come back from time at sea. So as you said earlier, and none of them are now at sea. So the curious thing about it is, in Argentina, when they just couldn't have a navy, and their Type 42 destroyers kind of sank at their moorings, and their submarines got so poorly maintained, and then unfortunately one of them was lost, and that was because they had no money at all. But it seems to me what's going on in the UK is there's quite a lot of money being spent. I think that's what you're saying, and it's being mismanaged, or the whole thing is structured wrong. So what's the cure? If there's money there in the system, is there any cure for this, or is it just going to stagger on like it is at the moment?
So the cure, culturally, the MOD is in it. That's one of the big challenges, the culture at the MOD. Hopefully, with the new NAD coming in at some point, and the way that the new TLBs are going to be put together, top-level budget holders, so Chief of Defence Staff, Permanent Secretary, the Nuclear Enterprise, and the NAD, hopefully that will better discipline the way that the money goes into the system, where you won't have single services always competing against each other for the pot of cash that's out there. Without looking at the capability, they look at their own mass. We need fighter jets because we're the Air Force, and without fighter jets, we haven't got identity. We need ships and submarines as the Navy. Without those, we haven't got identity. Same with the Army. We need tanks in the Army because we are the Army. Hopefully going forward, some of that will change. And the review that's going on now, the realism review that's going on now, is sort of saying, what do you need for the things that we want you to do? This is what the nation wants you to do. What things do you need? What platforms and capabilities do you need to do it? And you would hope that the single service chiefs and CDS will look at the estate that they've got and say, these are the things that we don't need. These are the things that we don't need anymore, because A, it doesn't meet the mission. B, we just cannot afford it. Argentinians hoping for a sunny day the next day to say, in case we can get a 42 out there, or we can get a submarine out there. I think we need to be more realistic with ourselves to say, guess what? We just can't do it. It's better investing the money in getting the people through the system than it is spending the money on leaving a ship alongside that's doing nothing. If we use the Air Force as a nice, easy example, there's a big debate going on at the moment about Typhoon. Do we buy another 24 Typhoons? If the money becomes available to buy the 24 Typhoons, where's the pilots coming from? Where's the training system coming from? But unless you've got the people to actually put in the seat to do the job, and you can fund them and you can look after them and you can make sure that they feel wanted, having lots of assets, all you have to do is travel up to Ashchurch and look at all the Challenger 2s that are sat in the park, having lots and lots of tanks. Unless you can actually use these things, what's the point in having them? And I think those conversations need to be had at Mod Main, to look really hard and really, treat the MOD like a patient that needs bits cut out of it to help it survive. Some of the dead flesh needs to be cut off, which is going to be extremely painful. And you'll get lots of lobbyists coming out in the Telegraph and the Sun and all the others to say, it wasn't like this in my day. The Navy is now the smallest since X, or the Army is now the smallest since Y. As long as it's a well-equipped Royal Navy, as long as it's a Royal Navy that's out at sea, as long as it's a Royal Navy that's doing its job, the thing that it's been asked to do, it doesn't need to be that big to fulfill all the tasks. It just needs to be out there doing stuff. We just need to make sure that what we've got is usable, deployable, supportable, and secure, instead of going to a dockyard and seeing lots of ships just sat there alongside. Whilst the ship is alongside, the crew that joins the Navy to go to sea, they're also sat alongside. those submariners set up in Faz Lane or down in Plymouth, you know, they join the submarine service to go on board submarines and to go and do their job. Some of them haven't been to sea for years. So from a skill fade point of view, from a capability point of view, all of that has to be trained back up again. You know, all of that cultural skill that we had in the 80s and 90s, I think you wrote a book about it, in fact, you know.
Sort of, yeah. Particulars, if somebody wants to buy it.
Yeah. You know, it's people feared us. You know, we were a submarine service that was out there doing the job. Currently, we are not out there doing the job.
No.
And to have, you know, 6 or 7 submarines when we could probably only sustain 4 or 5, why have 6 or 7? Why spend the money trying to keep HMS Astute afloat when it's the money potentially could be better spent getting the floating docks built to get the submarines that we do have through the system and back out the other end? No, we need a fleet of 7.
Yeah.
Why? When some of those, and you know, they cost so much money to maintain and sustain, it's eating away at the rest of the budget.
So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the Cold War book publicity aside, because what people don't perhaps realise is that when it came to being up the sharp end in the Barents Sea, then actually the UK contribution was, what, 1 or 2 boats at a time. And there were probably, what, 3 or 4, maybe not that many, special fit, i.e. capable of going up into the Russian Bears home waters with the special kit on. So actually that reputation for being formidable, and what, you know, Tom Clancy said, you know, which probably upset the US Navy, was that the Royal Navy's hunter-killer submarine captains and crews were the most feared by the Russians. And the Americans had lots, you know, dozens of attack submarines, and maybe sent 3 or 4 up there, but the RN would send 1 or 2. But that's how it got that reputation. Yes, there were more submarines elsewhere, but I'm just using it as a small case study. So being active, having a boat that's formidable and a fully trained, sharp crew that can go and do this stuff is, as you say, more valuable, and there's more point to it. And one of the things you've written about in the mag, in fact, the current edition, is that, and you know, this would cost money, but maybe you could get rid of something else to pay for this in the Navy, which maybe some people in the Navy wouldn't like to do. But maybe one of the things the Royal Navy needs to do is to go back to a mix of diesel electric submarines, although they would be diesel and air independent propulsion submarines of the German model, let's say, with those 4 or 5 SSNs. And then that would give the structure to the submarine service that would make them active. They would hone their warrior skills, if you like, their undersea warrior skills, give people a really good job to do out there in, let's say, 6 SSKs, you know, diesel electric boats. And then the 4 other submarines could be ranging further afield on strategic missions out into the deeper ocean. You've written about that. But I mean, that could be described as being in the realms of fantasy fleets. But do you think it's actually a sort of swerve that anybody that had cold, hard logic in their heart would think, actually, we should bin, you know, daring and maybe one of the astutes to get these SSKs? Do you think they would ever be as daring as that? Ha ha, pun intended.
Whether they'd be daring or not, if they, you know, you would hope that the fleet planners and the capability planners are looking at outcomes and outputs. What outputs do we need to meet the tasks that are at hand? And then they go through all the constraints from finance and all the other things that go on. So the recent SDR said it's a NATO-first approach. So we are changing our approach. We're going to become a NATO-first organisation. So when you're looking at, let's use the submarines, until the early 1990s, we had a mixed fleet. So we had upholder class and O class and P classes that would go out and do the patrolling and the special force fits and all the other bits and bobs. And then we'd have our SSNs that would go up to the high north, to the Barents Sea, and do other strategic missions. So you've got your strategic platform going out and doing stuff, and you've got your diesel electrics going and doing the patrolling and all of that. That was a capability with outputs that someone within the fleet planning department said, this is the best mix for doing those roles. Those roles haven't changed over 30 or 40 years. It's just the amount of money available to be able to do them. If we look at AUKUS, so AUKUS has demonstrated that by joining a couple of nations together, money suddenly becomes available. So August Lot 2 and all of that money is there, up to 12 It's the worst thing in the world, government say, we're going to buy up to 3 fleet solid support ships. We're going to buy up to 12 SSNs. It's a commitment without meaning anything at all. So I think that's where people and planners within the MOD and Treasury get mixed up. They have ambition to do a lot and reality to do very little. Going back to the AUKUS thing, so AUKUS money is available. That's Australian money, that's UK money, and that's American money. Can't we do the same with the SSK? There is the ideal opportunity for NATO to come together and say, right, we will pool our funding. Parts can be built in Barrow, parts can be built in parts. We've got a common weapon system, we've got a common C2 system, we've got a common propulsion system. That helps bring down cost, that makes training easier. That makes utilization easier. We can have mixed crews. Who would have thought of that? For NATO missions, there are mixed crews. Royal Marines would have their own AIP SSK capability again, instead of relying on the Dutch or the Norwegians. The SSKs are a lot cheaper, £400 million a unit compared to about £1.2, £1.3 billion a unit. When you start looking at these things and looking at outcomes across NATO, you would hope that those capability planners are saying, okay, if we were to get rid of one of our SSN attack boats and take it down to 6, from an outturn point of view, is that making much difference? We've got 5 at the moment and we've got none at sea. We've declared 7, we've got none at sea. So declare 6, get rid of 1, reinvest some of the money and collaborate with the Canadians, the Norwegians and others using industry. So that's the sovereignty piece being built again, to go and build platforms that can actually go out and do a job and a value for money. Their crews are 40 to 45. So from a crewing point of view, it's lighter, but it also means I'm getting more submarine captains through the system. And my Perisher course, which I can now offer to NATO, is now being used more regularly. I've got mass that I can actually use. More importantly, I can afford to use it. I'm guessing at the moment, the majority of Perisher courses are done in simulators. They must be, because we have no submarines at sea for them to be doing it on. So where are those new captains? Where are tomorrow's captains, tomorrow's crews being trained? And what are they being trained on?
We might be slightly late to the party there, though, with the Type 212, is it Type 212 or 214 CD submarine that Norway and Germany are building. So could we still get involved in something like that?
I can't see why not. So the Canadians need to replace, at some point, they'll need to replace their 4 upholders. So they will need to get those refreshed through the system. What would be the problem in picking a platform that's already proven? Oh, no, it's not sovereign. It's not designed in the UK. Yeah, but it's for a NATO mission. Does it work? Is it available? Can we build it? Does it meet the need? You know, we should be asking questions like that. From a sovereignty point of view, yes, for the M-boats, for Dreadnought and SSNX, fine. You know, we're doing that with the Australians and the Americans. There's sovereignty built into that. But for other things, if something is 80% good enough and we can get it to sea and we can use it, you know, why you hear a lot, the MOD like to gold plate everything. You know, Ajax, a nice easy example, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of requirements.
This is the Ajax AFV for the Army, yeah?
This is the noise box. I mean, sorry, the recce vehicle, that so a 44-ton recce vehicle replacing a 9-ton recce vehicle, you know, that's a whole different. It's looking, what outcome are you trying to achieve? What is the best way to achieve it with the money that you've got? If we have to go down a route where we are picking a submarine that's already been designed and built by someone else, but it's good enough, it meets the need, then why aren't we doing that? We can maintain it. We can sustain it in the UK. There's nothing wrong with setting up an MRO, maintenance, repair, and overhaul facility in the UK to do these things, to refit them. When it comes to budgets, everybody looks at the capital cost of buying an asset. Oh, we need to build it in the UK. Okay, once we've built it in the UK, where does it get maintained? Where does it get sustained? If you look at, again, I'll pick on the Air Force, the P-8, the E-7, most of the Boeing platforms, the Chinook, all purchased direct from the United States. The value goes back to the US. They're maintained in the US. You know, there are different ways that we can do these things where we can show the value for money and the money itself actually residing in the UK. So by the SSKs, we can refit them in the UK. We can repair them in the UK. You know, that's putting money back into the economy. That's, you know, showing a return. I think If we need to start looking at, I think I wrote about this as well, the Italian model, for example. So the way the Italian model works is, the Italian military have to show there is a return on investment back into the Italian economy. The Italian military don't control their own cash. It's, the cat A, cat B's is the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Industry. The MOD is very much the user, and they've got to fulfill certain criteria. If you look at their F-35, they've got Europe's MRO, maintenance, repair, and overhaul facility in Europe. So when the Belgians go to buy theirs, they get maintained and overhauled and built in Italy. When the Norwegians get theirs maintained, it goes to Italy. So Italy can say, yep, here is a return on investment on the F-35s that we're buying. So we get them. We get the A's that we need. We get the B's that we need. If you look at what they're doing with their surface fleet, within their naval force, it's a complete recapitalization. They've completely recapitalized their fleet, and it's pretty good for the amount of money that they're spending.
Yeah, I agree.
They are
getting,
and Italian ships look very pretty. So,
they do.
With the Italians, they are not afraid to cut things either. So they will, they will quite happily cut platforms to get other ones out there. They've got no sympathy or no, we need to get rid of that to do that, because the Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Industry are saying, if you want this, you need to do this. We should have something like that over here. Is the MOD the best to look after the budgets for Cat A and Cat B projects? I would say the NAO would disagree and have disagreed over the last 15 years.
That's the National Audit Office, which looks into
government
spending.
Which looks into the top 15 projects at the MOD. Every single year after year after year, they're either amber, red, or all red. The MOD then come back to say, yes, we've learnt lessons, we are continuously improving, and we're getting better. And then it's over budget again, and then it's over budget again, and things get moved to the right. More things get moved to the right. That money has to be spent at some point. And as you're moving more things to the right, you're leaving less space for new things to come through, which is why over the last 6 to 9 months, there has been no new capital announcements. Lots of contracts have been awarded. Serco were awarded their £1.6 billion contract. But these are run contracts. These are things to keep the lights on. Where are all those big new contracts all sat at the moment? They're all sat at Treasury, or they're all sat at IAB. Because if you're an economist, or if you're looking at the amount of money available against the amount of spend that's required, you've got a challenge. The budget either needs to go up, or things need to go. People talking about 3%, 3.5%. It's not going to happen in this parliament.
3.5%
declaring stuff,
defense, GDP,
and declaring stuff in the next parliament is great. I've got an ambition one day to own a Porsche, and I'm going to defer the payment of my Porsche until 2030, 2031. When it might not be me that's paying for it. So when we're looking at F-35 and stuff like that, the A models and all the other things, they're all being declared in the next parliament. So the government of the day can say, yep, we intend to do something, but we might not be in power. And if we're not in power, we can then blame the other lot for not doing it. And it's, that's just politics.
Yeah. And is it a case, therefore, of the curse of, to sum up that element of the chat, too much politics, not enough common sense? I mean, will it ever be sorted out, this kind of mess?
If you look at Yes Minister and those episodes in the 1980s, where someone somewhere needs to make a courageous decision, you would hope with a new government going in, regardless of your political affiliation, any new government going into any new department should look at that department and say, right, what are the things that are going well? What are the things that are going badly? Because the things that are going well, I can take credit for straight away, even though it's got nothing at all to do with me at all. That's just the way that politics work. Where are the things that are going wrong, and how can I change them? Reducing the top level budget holders down to 4, making CDS the senior warfighter, the only link, empowering CDS instead of being just a member of the board. He is now empowered as the chief military advisor into the Secretary of State for Defence.
So we have the new chief of defence staff. So what issues and what logical solutions are we talking about?
We use the army as a nice, easy example again. We need lots and lots of tanks. How are we going to get the tanks to where they need to be? How are we going to sustain them? How are we going to maintain them? The same with shipping, Royal Marines. How are we going to get them to where they need to be? How are we going to maintain them? How are we going to sustain them? Having lots of toys that can be counted every year and declared. So I'm the general, the air chief marshal, or the admiral to say, look at all my kit. How much of it can you actually use? Oh, no, I can't use it, but look at it all. Look, look, it's shiny and it's, you know.
Yeah.
And we get lost down that rabbit hole sometimes. And I'm hoping, and again, I go back to the statement that First Sea Lord made when CDS or CAS was made CDS.
Chief of the Air Staff Navy, was made Chief of the Defence Staff, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the tweet that he put out, I'm looking forward to something along the lines of, I'm looking forward to turning the Royal Navy into a war-fighting force. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's, whilst it's a throwaway line, if you read into that, that's a guy that's gone into the job, looked at what's around him, and has deemed, for whatever reason, the Navy isn't quite there yet from where it needs to be. And you would hope that he would, being the first Royal Marine in post, he's robust enough to make some decisions that are going to annoy some people and get some bad press.
You know, it's good if he shakes up things and the Royal Navy goes back to being a war-fighting force, as he says it. But it always strikes me that what happens a lot is that when politicians or whoever could be military leaders doing that habit of kicking things down the road and, you know, making those commitments without, you know, ever having to deliver on them, what they do is they seize upon, for example, drones, space, and other things that are cutting edge, or they seize upon a big industrial project that is like the plan to build up to 12 AUKUS SSN submarines and the dreadnoughts submarines. And they talk about jobs being created in certain parts of the UK that win votes, and that looks good, and they get to have photo opportunities there. Or they come down to Devonport and there's a big drone submarine there. You know, drones are part of the future. They are going to be useful. But it just seems to me that often they use things like that as the emperor's new clothes to kind of hide the fact that they're not doing anything with the other stuff, and they're trying to avoid investing in these new, like, ships for the Royal Marines, the, you know, the platforms for the Royal Marines, and putting off those decisions or not doing it at all, because they come up with excuses like they did to get rid of Albion and Bulwark, the two landing platform docks, which are now being sold for next to nothing to Brazil. They're old-fashioned, or we don't have the crew, or we have no use for them, and they're the past. And then I immediately think, well, okay, until you get the new Royal Marines platforms that they're going to use instead of LPDs, how would you rescue people from a war zone? Like, let's say it all goes to, you know, hellfire in the United Arab Emirates with the Strait of Hormuz closed, you know, and the Iranians, I know it might be unlikely, but the Iranians devastating the UAE, where we've now got hundreds of thousands of expats living. How are you actually going to lift those people off a beach or help rescue them or have a platform to command an evacuation if the airports are destroyed and you can't get aircraft in? And let's say there's very few allies that are going to help you. So in that 10-year span, when you think that drones are it and you don't need LPDs and you're putting off the decision to get new ships for the Royal Marines, then you could be caught, you know, with your pants down, couldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I'll use the car analogy again. It's like I'm telling your family you're going to get a new car, so you're going to get rid of the old car, but we're not getting a new car for 2 years. So you say, well, how are we going to get around? Well, that, you know, don't worry, we've got friends. We'll borrow John's car, or we'll borrow Sheila's car or something like that, or we'll buy bikes. We'll all go around on bikes. You know, we'll call them novel amphibious craft or whatever we want to call them, or we'll find a different way of doing it. And again, partly it comes down to money. Partly it comes down to freeing up that cash to allow those capital investments to be taken. If we look at things like future solid support ship and stuff like that, these things have been going on since 2015, 2016. So those requirements have been there for years, and it's been deferred and deferred and deferred. So we're not going to get anything now out until about 2033 at the earliest. So what do the Royal Marines do then? If you look at high mast at the moment, we've got no solid support ships. RFA Victoria isn't going to sea again. Get rid of her. You know, stop holding on to things that the reality is she's not going to see again. She won't pass in Lloyd's inspections, and invest in the things that we can do. the LPDs, so the two landing platform docks, the art of warfare at the littoral has changed. When we talk about the littoral, sorry, we're talking about anywhere 100 miles either side of the forward edge of the battle area, the beach. So that's the littoral space when we talk about that. So when people are talking about the littoral, that's what they mean, 100 side miles either side of where they land on the beach or whatever shore they land on. LPDs are vessels that are designed to come to about 12 miles in, launch their LCUs and LCVPs, and then go and do their thing. The risk assessment is that they are that close now to the enemy that they'll just get obliterated. Two phalanx on the back is not enough to protect that platform. And so a balanced judgment was made for whatever reason, partly because of cost, partly because of crew. If you've got two aircraft carriers going out to sea, you can't man two LPDs. You just do not have the bodies, the numbers, to be able to do it. So someone within Navy command has made that decision to say carrier strike is more important than amphibious lift. Royal Marines, you have to find another way of doing your business. Hence, they've now come up with, you know, we're now NATO soft. We're now going to be small teams. We're going to go back to our commando roots and we're going to do X. You know, in some ways, I agree with that. The days of large beach landings, of whole brigade groups landing on the beach, those days are gone. But you have to be able to get them to battle in the first place to be able to go and do the things that they want to be able to do. There will be now a capability gap for a couple of years because we have no shipping to do that. You know, RFA Argus, 45, nearly 50 years old. She is not the platform to do that. The LPDAs, the Bay class, we can't man them. You know, we can't. There's not enough RFA crew to make sure that these vessels, and they're not warships. So Albion and Bulwark are warships. When you go on board these vessels, the first thing you notice is the number of pipes and cables. The big difference between the number of pipes and cables on a warship compared to an auxiliary. That's all the redundancy that needs to be built into a warship to make sure that if it does get hit, the warship can still operate. So to get it close to danger, it's designed to do that. The LPDAs, they're great, but they're the auxiliary vessels that are there to sit 20 or 30 or 40 miles offshore, waiting for the first stage of fighting to be done, to go in then and reinforce. We're now using those vessels, pushing them further forward to more into the risky areas. There's no redundancy on the vessel to do that. We'll use the recent issues in, or the recent troubles in Israel, Syria, and around there. The last time that happened, I think an LPD went down there and we ran rescue missions and did all the other things. We ferried in there. The UK has lost the ability to do that now. It's a capability that the Americans really liked because it's a gap filler. It means that the Americans don't have to go around and do everything. That capability is down. That gap can no longer be filled by us. And when, again, it goes, when you lose something, it's very, very difficult to get back. So now the Americans will say, okay, we've lost that from the Brits. We'll go and find something else. So when the Brits turn back up to say, we've come back, we've got one now, the US have moved on. You know, the Allies have said, we don't use you anymore. You know, we've evolved. We've found different ways of you know, doing these things. It's a challenge for the Corps over the next 4 or 5 years because they have no shipping. You know, they are going to have to borrow the Dutch. They're going to have to borrow the US Marine Corps or the US Navy to be able to make sure, going back to the submarine analogy as well, to make sure they keep their skills up to be able to do the job that they're entrusted to do. With no submarines, we can't train our parishes and our crews. Without amphibious landing vessels, we can't land amphibiously. We have nothing to do it with.
Yeah. I mean, that the operation to evacuate people from the Lebanon 2006 involved a carrier and I believe one of the LPDs, but also interestingly, they flew Seeking helicopters from Cyprus all the way to the Lebanon to rescue people. But that was done in a permissive environment, of course, because Hezbollah, although they attacked with an anti-shipping missile an Israeli warship and hit it, they weren't in the game then of attacking British ships, because there was a Type 42 alongside in Beirut. But yes, so what you said there about vessels need to be further out or they're toast, that's true. And then what you also commented on there about the fact that if you don't have it, when you is permissive to go do that that humanitarian aid and disaster relief or rescue mission, you have nothing to even go in there at all, even when you can negotiate a way in to do it or you've got a safe environment. Yeah.
You've got to imagine the minister going into the room, looking at his, he or she looking at their chiefs of defence staff and saying, what have we got to do X? And they're looking back at you and saying, sorry, we don't have anything. The locker is empty at the moment. If you ask the Brazilians, though, they've got a fantastic amphibious fleet that we could borrow. It works very, very well. We know how to use it. We know how all the kit works. But again, that risk register that the MOD holds, more and more risks are being put in it. And more risks, so if I'm the Treasury guy and I'm looking at the MOD to say, well, if you're accepting these risks, if you're happy to accept the risk, the capability gap, I'm not going to fund you, or I'm not going to fund you this year because I have higher priorities, NHS, social care. There are higher priorities out there than fulfilling something that you've already managed, or you've got a risk that says you can mitigate against it. And again, that's where I think the MOD then get worried to think, well, we need to keep the platform alongside because at least we can show the Treasury, look, we need it because it's there. We need HMS Derry. We need six destroyers. I'm the Treasury, but you only ever use four. But just in case. Well, how long is it going to take to get Daring up and running? Well, it's going to take 18 months. Do you have the crew to do it? No. Do you have the missiles to put on board? No. But it's there, because we've bought it now and we need to show size. So you can see this sort of loop that goes around at the top to say, well, I can raise a risk, but the Treasury is looking to say, if you're happy with risks, why am I spending money? Because we've got higher priorities. So you've got the MODs then saying, well, I can't do that. So I'm going to have to pay for the thing that I can't afford to use, because I can't put a risk against it because the Treasury will take it off me.
Thanks for listening to part one of our two-part discussion with Lee, and please tune in for the next helping.